Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Australian speculative fiction author Dirk Flintart. Welcome to the podcast, Dirk.
G'day, Sean. Pleasure to be here.
All right, I'll launch straight into it. You've been a stalwart of the Australian speculative fiction scene for quite a while now, but Path of Night is your first published novel, and I wondered what led to the change from short fiction to the novel form?
Well, short fiction, I love it. I have to admit, I've always loved it since I was very small. And the art of wrapping up a story in such a tight space, making every word count, will never be far from my heart. I do like short stories. But I think everybody who writes wants to try something different once in a while, and I've been itching to tackle the long form. So, you know, there's been a couple of minor efforts here and there, and the odd rejected manuscript. But what happened was that I took up a master's degree in creative writing through the University of Tasmania. Now, that may not seem like the best of catalysts for creating a novel, especially as the novel itself has absolutely no bearing on the degree. But I chose to study genre fiction for fairly obvious reasons. And while I was doing the research and the reading, it dawned on me that most of us out there in the world of writing were potentially making something of a mistake.
Okay.
Yeah, this is your cue. You're supposed to say, really?
Really?
Yeah, it's when you think about it, when I got started writing, and when most of us who are now doing this got started, the only real goal, the only real path through to publication was to work your prose, to refine what you did, to try to catch the eye of the people in charge of distribution and publishing and marketing and the rest of it. And that's absolutely fine. That's a great way of getting started. But if you look at the books that are beginning to flood the market now, without wanting to name too many names, Dan Brown, you realize that the prose, the quality of the writing, is not the be-all and end-all by any means. And as a matter of fact, the large publishing firms are less concerned with the absolute quality of your writing than they are with its marketability. Which means that there's another and potentially more useful path to acquiring an audience. And another thing that I realized from studying this degree, I went back and I looked over the history of publishing, etc., and I realized that we are in what I would call the fourth great wave of change in terms of information distribution and production. Gutenberg. From there, you can move to the Industrial Revolution, the unification. No, that's not the right word. The industrialization of paper, print, and binding. That made it far more accessible and easy for people to get hold of these written works. And the third wave is, of course, the modernization of distribution, the advent of the petrol engine, worldwide road, etc. So that leads to the era of pulp fiction, you know, and the true beginning of fiction as a commodity, if you like. Now we're at the fourth wave. We've reached the point where the internet permits people like me and you access to a wider audience. Interestingly, at every stage of these technological changes, each one of these technological changes, you get writers who stand out and are marked by great success, relatively speaking. Most interestingly of all, it's not always the good writers. In fact, it's usually the ones that were most prolific. So I looked at all of this and I realized, hello, I've reached the point now where it takes the larger publishing firms a good 2 years to finish rejecting a novel manuscript. Might be time to try something different. So I set out to write a book that was just plain fun, to go back, enjoy my writing again, stop obsessing over the absolute quality of the prose. I figure I've got a few awards. I've been patted on the back often enough. I can probably write adequately. And I wanted to write a book that people could really enjoy reading. Hopefully, I've managed that.
Well, yes, I was just going to say it was. I put up my review of your book yesterday, I think it was, and you may know, having done perhaps some reviews yourself, if you're doing it for any great length of time, you can start to get a bit tired and hit a wall, and I found the path of night somehow slipped under my guard, so to speak, and it was just nice fun. Quite good, very Aussie humour matched with good pacey action. So I think personally for me it's worked. So and I think probably for everyone else who's going to read it too, I think it's hit that sweet spot, if you will.
I'm hearing good things about it from the people who have reviewed it, and I'm very grateful because they seem to have the air quotes here. They seem to get it. You're quite right. It's the mingled Australian humour, action, pace. Yes, I set out to be fun, but you see, there's one of the advantages of small press. I didn't really think that with the quite Australian language and characterization and even setting, that I could take this manuscript to a publisher whose major goal was to sell overseas. It isn't that I don't believe it would sell overseas. It's that I think convincing a major publisher that they could accept the Australian idiom would be very, very difficult. I called my friend John Birmingham's efforts to see falafel taken to the U.S. It did fine in Italy. It did fine in New Zealand. It did fine in England. But every time they started to talk about a U.S. version, they kept going, well, this word flatmate over here, you know, that means a couple of gay guys. And John just kind of cringed. You get the picture. I probably could take this to a larger publisher, and eventually it may wind up going that way. But hopefully by that stage I will be able to stand my ground and say, well, no, I don't want to make this a generic thriller. I want to keep the Australian flavor. I want the vernacular. I want the voice. And that's absolutely true. I wanted to write something that felt like home.
Yeah, and I tend to have I can understand the marketing point of view from big marketing firms in the US where their point is to just practically make money. But I think from a cultural point of view, it always sort of just grates with me. I've talked with Kylie Scott, who writes sort of erotic zombie horror as one of her books, and I asked her the same question about having to change words before it was taken to the States. And my personal argument is, you're reading an Australian author. Why are you reading an Australian author if you just want it to be sort of McFiction, if you get my point there?
I think that's an excellent point, and that's precisely my take on the matter. I have had feedback from some Americans, and they've all said, yes, we've had to take in a few new words, but hey, we can pick them up from context, and actually this is a lot of fun. I firmly believe that the American public is quite capable of translating from the Australian, and I think they'll even enjoy it.
I mean, you just need to point to the success of Crocodile Dundee to argue that point.
Need we go there?
No, okay.
But it is a good point, right. Yes.
Moving on from there, my next question we've practically talked about because I was going to ask where the humour came from, but I think you've answered that.
Well, there's also a certain touch of Joss Whedon in there. I found as I went through that there were an awful lot of classic thriller tropes. The main character is an everyman. He's an Australian everyman. And when you read most thrillers, your heroes are square-jawed, bright-eyed graduates of the CIA Kill Everybody Academy. And they take these ridiculous situations that they get into for granted. They're perfectly happy to find themselves hanging from a clifftop doing battle with, a fiendish terrorist. I never envisioned myself that way. I kind of thought that if I ever wound up in the bottom of the enemy fortress, it would probably be more embarrassing than anything else.
No, I was just thinking, you're talking about square jawed. I was thinking of, Lee Child's ex-marine, sort of Superman hero type of characters. But what I wanted to sort of focus or telescope in on was Path of Night is ostensibly sort of vampire fiction, a vampire action thriller with classic Aussie wit. What were your concerns entering into that sort of thoroughly ploughed subgenre?
Let me see. It just seemed like an interesting space to go. I guess I wasn't thinking of any particular genre. It was more about having a story and an idea, and it played out well in that kind of subgenre. There are a few other things to consider. What I was interested in doing, I expect to run this for 5 or 6 books, because that's a good way to acquire some momentum, and more because I've actually got at least 5 or 6 books worth of material surrounding the two main characters. It's all, you know, sort of lined up and ready to go. But one thing about using this particular subgenre, so to speak, is that I don't know if you've noticed, but in a lot of the series, what's the plural of series? Must be series. You wind up by book 3 or 4, there's a real problem the writers face, which is they've been ramping up the power levels. Take the Anita Blake series. You're familiar with them?
I haven't read them, but I've heard them spoken of. My vampire fiction is in other areas, probably.
Just an example. But, you know, in book 1, she's raising zombies. But by book 4 or 5, she seems to be battling the entire universe of undead, added in with werewolves, demons, and everything else under the sun. It's this idea that with each book, you've got to, you know, raise the stakes. I can understand that. It makes sense. But I thought there might be another way to do it. And what I'm hoping to do with this is to expand the background. You will recall there's a certain degree of politicking and hints of conspiracy and the rest going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I anticipate, given that vampires are such a marvelous historical thing, that I can, rather than trying to build the power of the enemies and make things more frantic, I think that I can work by revealing more of the complexity and giving these lead characters, who currently really don't know much about it all, giving them a more and more important role as they go in a broader world of, vampire conspiracy and fiendish plans from ancient history.
Okay, so it's more the mystery that's drawing the reader on rather than, you know, just pumping up the power levels.
Yep, precisely. I don't think I could actually stand to write a series where I sort of had to, you know, generically build things higher with every book. I mean, there's only so many times you can add an ever more superpowered opponent to the mix before you finally sit there and go, oh, come on, this is silly.
You were making a point there, and I just thought about a certain writer who we won't mention who starts to introduce fairies and other fae creatures towards the end of the 13 book series, but which annoyed me in terms of, you know, being a bit more of a straight vampire fan. Aside from your own work, which obviously you enjoy, what vampire fiction do you enjoy, and what's made you sit up and sort of take notice?
Well, I remember I've been reading for quite a long time, and my parents were actually very supportive of it. So, look, I kicked off with Bram Stoker and Dracula, which is the great-grandfather of them all and remains to this day a really excellent work. But I can remember being given Interview with a Vampire when I was about, I don't know, 10 years old and being sent off to school camp. And having been familiar already with Dracula and with the movie versions, Dad was a huge horror film fan. that was a bit of a revelation. It was a reinterpretation of vampirism. And while I may not have enjoyed much of the later material that Anne Rice brought out, I was certainly interested in the direction that she took it. These days, vampires are pretty thoroughly embedded in the pop culture. Actually, I quite like the debate from the U.S. that says, you know, when the Republicans are elected, it's all about the zombie movies, and when the Democrats are elected, it's all about the vampire movies. as for what vampire fiction is currently, there's nothing really central that I'm following. Mostly short stuff, you know. I guess it's such a well-known trope that I actually rather like the little things that people do with it rather than the grand things. I once wrote a Vampire Elvis story, by the way. It was more or less just to prove to myself it could be done.
Fair enough. Oh, I've got visions of Bubba Hotep, if you've seen the movie.
Yes, yes, it's an excellent film. No, it came out in one of Cat Spikes' Agog books. It was a lovely concept, the idea that Elvis had not died. He'd actually agreed to take on vampirism in order to live forever, right? But after that, he could only get a living as an Elvis impersonator, and he was increasingly not in demand.
I'm going to have to track this down.
It was a nice concept. I still like it.
Yeah. All right. Switching on to another part of your wondrous and interesting career in life. Path of Night features some martial arts. So did Angel Rising from memory. You've personally practiced for about 30 years?
Yeah. One day I may even get it right.
I was wondering, I was going to say, yeah, I've got a bit of a background in martial arts, and when I read a depiction of martial arts, there's usually a few things that tick me off, and I wondered what annoyed you about depictions of martial arts in science fiction and fantasy?
Ooh, see, now you're getting really complicated and philosophical. I actually teach a defensive form of jiu-jitsu, more or less traditional, but directed towards defensive ends. And in order to do so, I've done a fair bit of study and reading, and I'd have to recommend a guy called Rory Miller. Does the name ring any bells?
It does. I'm just trying to think.
Miller's an American. He actually mostly worked, he's been police, he's been SWAT, he's been a prison guard and a number of other things, but he's the clearest thinker that I know on violence. His work is very, very sharp. He's a very good thinker. And I guess it's Miller's ideas on the nature of violence and what it's about and how it works and what it's for. When martial arts get depicted, there's so much of the Bruce Lee and the dojo, the one-on-one combat, take a pose, strike, counter-strike. And the real world is nothing like that at all.
No, I don't agree.
Now, I definitely understand the need for cinematic scope. When you film a fight sequence for a movie, people want to see what's going on. There's no reason for it not to be pretty and interesting. But there ought to come some sort of a disclaimer. Kids, don't try this at home. It won't work. And I guess I think of books. I don't see quite the same need for eye candy. I think there's a need to evoke emotion and, if you like, a degree of realism. So if you recall the end of Path of Night, there's that fight between, my good guy and my bad guy. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly full on, but it's definitely not nice, clean strikes or anything else. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, look, I was going to mention, because I found the action in Bath of Night more to my liking. I tend to come from a bit of a reality-based background, and the psychological side of the fight and realism is a bit more important to me.
Yeah, agreed. That was very important to me too. I didn't want people who would just walk into fights with the assumption that they're immortal and come out afterwards going, "Gosh, we did that well." And, the only times where I've seen people, or been part of violence myself, there's been a considerable aftermath. It's, not something that you do easily. And I guess that's another of my issues with your classic thrillers, I guess I don't relate well to people who can walk into a room with their Glock, waste five enemies, and then, head out and make a cup of tea.
they're sociopaths, aren't they?
Yeah, it looks that way to me, yes.
No. Oh, moving on to something that caught me in your live journal as I was trying to run through and scoop out some juicy goss. you're completing your master's degree, or you're still underway at the moment?
I'm still working on a master's degree, yes. I have to see my professor tomorrow, actually.
And you've handed in a 14,000-word epic poem in Otago Rima format, which we can't talk about because it's under academic embargo. 14,000 words, how deep is your love for poetry?
I do like poetry, but interestingly enough, it's a limited thing. I find there's, you know, a dozen poets, and from each of them I might like four or five pieces. You know, Emily Dickinson has got two or three that really shift, you know, they make me feel something. Dylan Thomas, Yeats, there's another female writer, and I can't remember who she was. There will come the long rains. Bradbury quotes her in one of his stories, and I went and looked her poetry up as a result and found it was absolutely lovely. But I'm not by any means a dedicated poemophile. The thing is that the master's degree is about looking for ways to work within genre fiction to make it more challenging and more interesting, so to speak. And it happens I'm also working on something, a novel related to Regency period. And one of the major figures, of course, from there is Byron. And it fits with the novel to write a piece as though it was Byron, which was... my professor kind of freaked out. I handed him the poem, which is this complicated little, it's eight lines per verse, and there are 10 syllables in every line, iambic pentameter, and the rhyme scheme is AB, 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 CC. And working within those restrictions, Byron used 120,000 words to create Don Juan, and I understand the pronunciation is Don Juan, not Don Juan, which I think is dreadful, but what do you do? So, yeah, Byron managed 120,000 words of that. I'm at, you know, 14. It's not really that terrible, but my poor professor, he's a very nice guy, but he just sat there and goggled at it when I handed it to him.
No, well, that makes it sort of what you've outlined there fits into. I can understand why you're doing the poetry there. I was going to go on and ask, do you think we'll make it specific? Do you think the Australian speculative fiction scene could do with more poetry, and perhaps what do you think are the barriers to appreciation of it?
Oh. That's a really interesting question. You dialect out on me in one line, so I'm just going to repeat it back. You were saying, do I think that the Australian fiction scene could do with more poetry, and what might be barriers to it?
Yeah, specifically the Australian speculative fiction scene, the fantastic, I suppose, is what I'm getting at there.
Okay, well, this is where some of that master's degree stuff comes in. I am not the target market for most of the publishers. I'm a very broad reader. I do like speculative fiction, and I will read imaginative works over literary works. But you know, every year they drop those lists of the 100 books you must have read, and last year I idly glanced at it and realized that of the 100 I'd read 90. mostly by accident, but yeah, you know, I'm a very broad reader, so I quite enjoy poetry, and I like the effects of poetry when used well. Who was it? Cordwainer Smith. He incorporated ancient Persian verse forms into some of his stories, and that is one thing that we can do with speculative fiction. I mean, we're forever creating alternative worlds and alternative histories. There is a history and a tradition of non-existent books cropping up in speculative fiction, and there's no particular reason why we can't explore the culture. I'm kind of losing the direction here. It's a very interesting question in a big way. Do you remember the Canterbury Tales thing I did a few years ago?
Canterbury Tales 2100, was it?
Yeah. Yep. The goal there was to create an alternate future for all the writers and let them write the folk stories of that alternate future, and to let the reader address those and try to, in their own mind, rebuild this future history by reading the folk stories. To me, that remains an absolutely fascinating idea. And I've absolutely loved it when good writers have played with that kind of thing. Samuel Delaney, what's the series he did? Erewhon? Yes, Erewhon, that's it.
Erewhon.
Okay, he builds a non-existent historical culture, but it's rich with poetry and storytelling, and it's fascinating. And Tolkien, much the same. His drawing from the Old English and the Old Norse material enriched his work beyond measure. It really made it readable. So, standalone poetry, I don't know. I'm the wrong person. Like I say, three pieces from one poet, two from another. So do I think there's a demand for a sort of mass market of poetry? Nah, probably not.
No.
But if anybody wants to produce poetry that catches the eye and spins the heart a new way, I don't mind whether it's embedded in speculation or otherwise. And there's certainly room for it in the speculative fiction genres, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, there was probably two things that made me think of that. And one was I'm submitting poetry myself, but I noticed that some American publications do carry poetry. Speculative fiction publications do carry poetry, whereas Aurealis, and it's no criticism of them, but they don't accept poetry. And so I was thinking about this, and I'm thinking, well, that's really unfortunate for me. But and then I noticed that on Goodreads, the review site, that Tolkien's posthumous Fall of Arthur topped out the poetry category.
Uh-huh.
For the year's best, and I just thought, yeah, okay. So I think probably zeroing in on what you've said there, a collection of poetry is, probably not the best marketing idea.
Yeah, it's problematic.
I thought that was interesting. I think there is perhaps a love of what most people would see as poetry, which is sort of rhyming poetry that tells a story in the general populace. Where I've read quite a bit of academic poetry, and frankly, that scares me.
Yes, I can't blame you. I dread someday I'm sure to come across postmodernist poetry, and at that point, I think I'm going to have to find the writer and just butcher them.
All right, then. I was going to say, I've run out of questions, Dirk. Is there anything else that that you want to plug, other than saying Path of Night's available from Fablecroft and all good e-tailers at this point in time?
Ooh, no, if anything, I would simply like to say thank you, by and large, to actually the Australian speculative fiction community that I've dealt with for the last 10 to 15 years. It was interesting when I first got into the SpecSic community. Most of my friends were still the people that I knew from university and so forth. But, you know, the usual diaspora, I hardly get to see those folks anymore. But the people that I have met through the conventions and writing and through being parts of different and anthologies and so forth have been some of the finest people it's ever been my privilege to know. And I am absolutely delighted by the degree of friendship and support that has come over the years, and I'm looking forward to giving it back.
All right. I would concur. Thanks for that, Dirk.
No worries.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you.
I assure you, the pleasure is entirely mine, sir.
And that, dear listeners, brings us to the end of the podcast and the end of our season. From all the crew here at Galactic Chat, we'd like to wish you a merry holiday period, Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year. Thanks again. See you next year.